Hello. Good evening.
So we both read this book. I mean, you read it earlier, Presentation of Self in Everyday Life. And you reread it and I read it for the first time. And the main thesis of the book is that a lot of socializing is structured by the idea of a front stage and a backstage, so that there's aspects of oneself or one's life that one is presenting to others almost in the, as though you're an actor playing a role. And then there's, you know, what's not visible to others. And there can be often or typically you're going to be have teammates. So you may be playing roles together with others. And then there's an audience of people who are themselves are in some sense together. Right. And so a lot of our social lives have this structure. I mean, I guess one question I had for you about this is, this seems like an alternate way of presenting the idea of signaling, like a different mode of presentation of a lot of the same facts. How does it compare from your point of view?
Well, first of all, you have to admire its prestigious. He's giving it a highbrow framing that is, at least people today and his audience probably thought of plays and actors as prestigious. And so he's taking what you might have looked down on and might have seen as sullied or dirty and given this highbrow framing, which helps him sort of treat it from a distance and analytically and not be very critical of it per se, as many people might be tempted to be. That was an admirable, I guess, effect, sort of to give people the space to sort of just consider it analytically without moralizing quickly about it.
I agree that he does that. I don't think the acting framing is particularly conducive to that. I mean, that is like, you know what the word, the hypocrite, that word, you know what the etymology of it is?
No.
It means actor in Greek. Hippocrates is an actor.
Right. Well, clearly we've separated those connotations by now.
I mean, I think people often use have negative associations with acting, like it's false, it's being fake. I have negative associations personally with acting. And I would say, like, the idea of a signal, right? Like your idea, that just sounds like, you know, a package of information. It's non-valenced. If somebody told me there were two treatments of this phenomenon, and one of them said people are spend their whole lives acting in front of other people, and there's this backstage stuff they don't show, and the other one was like, well, people are sending all sorts of informational signals, and we're not like aware of all the signals that we're sending. I would have said the second one is the dispassionate and detached one, and the first one, but you're right, that's not actually how it plays out. But I don't think it's the framing.
Well, so I do agree that just merely sending signals and communicating isn't particularly problematic. It's when there's this conflict between two levels of signals where they don't entirely agree. And that's the degree to which signaling is often sort of, it's an indirect way of communicating something that's often at odds with other things you might say, or at least, there's the interesting question, why did you use this other channel of communication when you could have just said it directly? The thing I most noticed about the book on reflecting on it was in comparison with our book, The Elephant in the Brain, was that he talks about people managing an impression, and he does mention it many times that it's an impression that might be false. Or that could be seen to be false. And in fact, he more focuses on whether one impression would be at odds with another. And he doesn't really dwell much on whether it's just a false impression. but although he could, but he doesn't, really puzzle over why it is that one would need to hide anything at all. Why can't you just be open and honest about everything? He sort of is, presumes that there are many secrets that you would need to protect in order to be on stage. And he goes with that and talks about various mechanisms by which they might secretly communicate and make sure that they have the same front, together. But elephant in the brain sort of goes in the, you know, the opposite extreme of talking about how you aren't even aware that you're doing these things and that you might deny that you are doing things if asked, and to focus on that conflict. And that's the thing I didn't remember about the book, is that it's pregnant or potentially in the book, but he doesn't really highlight that or even sort of clarify that it's really there, that there really is a conflict between what the people might think they're doing and what they're really doing.
I think that he doesn't see a conflict. That is, I think that like an elephant in the brain, there's this idea of what's really happening and what you think is happening, where it's clear that you, the authors, are, you know, have come down on a side in terms of, well, you say that you want, you know, are interested in this person's health, but really you just want to show them that you care, something like that. That's what's really happening, right? And I think that it's not like Goffman doesn't think of what's happening backstage as what's really happening. He just thinks there's two things happening. There's a front stage and a backstage. And
he does say that you're more natural or authentic or yourself backstage. He gives that sort of a characterization to it, but he doesn't emphasize it that much.
You know, there's that passage with, like, there's a bunch of, he quotes Simone de Beauvoir a bunch of times. And, you know, about how women are like more themselves with other women, but then they're performing with the men. And I thought there was one place where he was sort of saying, like, yes, a lot of women just feel more alive and better when they're performing, and that in some sense is more real for them. Right. So it's not obvious to me that he was coming down there on the idea that the backstage is more natural or more authentic.
He does have many specific examples of sort of deception being involved. I mean, I talk about a doctor recommends you to a specialist and doesn't acknowledge that there might be a kickback involved. Or he talks about how service workers would be pleasant and subservient to you and then insult you and make fun of you off stage.
Yeah. But I think even in those passages, he wants to be very clear. Like, it's not clear that what they really think is the insulting, like the insulting is a culture that they're in over there. Right. And like, I don't think he sees the doctor thing as deception. I think he's just, they're not telling you this. So here's one phrase that he uses a couple of times that I found tantalizing that I wished he would have explained better. He talks about that what's happening backstage is focused on achieving technical standards, that there's something technical that was happening backstage and there's something performative or impression management or something, or expressive about the front stage. Right. So you might say he seems to divide human life into these two functions that he thinks has to operate separately from one another, the technical and the expressive. I don't think he thinks of one as more real than the other, but I think it's interesting that he sees them as divided. And I wasn't sure what he meant by technical.
Well, so at the very beginning, there's this idea that the group of people is managing an impression. So you and I are teachers, and he has examples where teachers have a certain persona with respect to the students, and they need to maintain that. And part of that is a distance. And so if we're too open with ourselves, say, a therapist does something similar, you know, where they ask you about your personal life, and if you probe their personal life, they say, no, that's, we don't go there. That's not what this relationship's about. And, you know, in some sense, Goffman is saying that's true for a lot of other relationships, that, when you're performing, other aspects of yourself are to be suppressed and not, you know, expressed, and that that's part of the thing. And so that if you'll have to conspire to keep that going, and you may at times want to relent, and your co-conspirator teammates will, you know, pressure you and help you maintain the facade. And then backstage is where you are sort of being more natural with each other, but working together about the facade, sort of, you know, strategizing about the facade, talking about the audience on the other side, if you were to go front stage. And so that's at least his initial framing, is that backstage is where you who are maintaining the facade can sort of more directly talk to each other and relax and sort of do various things that maintain this boundary and watch out for people who aren't supposed to be back there and having to, you know, put on the facade suddenly if people come backstage.
But I also think it's the backstage isn't just about managing the front stage. That is, there's real work that needs to be done, right?
Right.
So one way that he puts it is expression versus action. That is, there's a trade-off between expression and action. And he has a really interesting point early on about that there are certain jobs where that trade-off doesn't show up because the job itself is very dramatic. So like firefighters and musicians and surgeons. And he says, if you look at what a kids want to be when they grow up, it's always one of those jobs.
Right.
And that's because those are the jobs where the very doing of the job is a performance. Right. And that's different from, say, a teacher. The teacher has the prep, like class prep, right, that they're doing, where they're preparing the lecture, and then you give the lecture. And there's a separation between the prep, which is the backstage, and the giving of the lecture. Right. That's one without a team. You're just, yourself.
Right.
What's happening backstage is not, I mean, it's not just like impression management, like you're actually doing the actual work of things.
Right. So his favorite example is the restaurant, I think.
Yeah.
So and right, he gets a lot of mileage, right? So the impression management is like the space in which you are served the food and you're asked about the food and you eat the food. And then there's the kitchen where the food is made and disposed of. And, the idea is that people eating food and asking for it don't want to see how it's made. And even though they know abstractly that that happens, they would rather it happen off stage. And therefore, the technical works have to happen off stage. And that's true about many kinds of things. You think about building maintenance or something, right? In our buildings, behind the walls, there's all sorts of pipes and wires and all sorts of things. And between the floors, and there are people whose job it is to sort of go in the back rooms and the back panels and, manage, change the light bulbs, et cetera. And we don't want to see that. And so, the custodial work is in some sense backstage work because the front stage of the clean office has to have somebody clean it once in a while, but we don't want to see that. And so it happens when we're, say, gone home for the day.
Right. So every kind of work that basically it's like you do some kind of work and there is the work component and there's the sort of communicative component or something.
Right.
And you have to manage both of those things. And I just think it's really interesting that he sort of solves this puzzle that I've had. I think you've mentioned it of like, why do kids want certain jobs? Right.
Well, now,
there's certain jobs that appeal.
Like musician and athlete. But I mean, musicians spend most of their time practicing and athletes spend most of their time practicing, and the game itself or the performance itself is only a small fraction of all their efforts. But maybe it's just that the practicing is close to the performance. And
I think that that's right. And that at the very least, we don't think of the practicing as having to be like as hidden or like ugly in some way or like cheating or, and maybe that's not true. I mean, maybe there are things that, but we don't think of it that way. And so it may be that this idea that, acting like that social life separates into these two components of acting and expressing, is alien to children. Is that something you have to learn? Right. And children, it's true, are not very performative, I think. They often will misbehave. And he talks about this, right? They'll misbehave. You don't allow the child to come into certain spaces until they're old enough to know that they're supposed to perform, which young children don't know they're supposed to perform, right? Like young children don't know that, like when you have guests over, we want you kids to make us look good. And so we want you to like behave well, right? A baby's not gonna behave well. So this thing, this very thing that Goffman is talking about front stage versus backstage, is not something we intuitively get as like babies or young children. We have to learn it. And so the jobs that are going to show up as appealing to children are going to be ones that don't require one yet to have mastered this distinction.
I think there's a further part, which is that we often have idealized concepts of an activity, and the backstage somewhat belies that ideal. So I was thinking about, say, if you see someone giving a passionate speech, and then if you saw them practicing the speech, you might see them sort of trying each line with different emphasis on different words. And then you might realize that the emphasis they had in the speech wasn't spontaneously, representing the emotions that are trying to be conveyed, that it was all very carefully planned. And that might you know, on reflection, you might realize, I guess that's how it goes, but it sort of takes away this myth that the speaker is just this passionate, smart person who is telling you these things that come to his mind.
Yeah. So that's one of the things that Offman talks about, is that there's this sort of conceit that every performance is unique or is spontaneous, or like, I can't remember what the right word, right? But it's like, there would be a problem if you found out that the conversation the shopkeeper was having with you was just the exact one she has with every single person who comes in there.
He talks very specifically about, say, a maitre d' or some host at the entrance of a place who might go out of the way and say, oh, it's so great to see you. I haven't seen you in a long time. How are the kids? And go through this big performance as if you were a special person. And then if you saw them do that to the next five people in a row, you might not find it so special. And so they have to have a special room where they can do this special performance just for you to give you the illusion that you're being treated differently.
Yeah. So I wonder, why that's the case. That is, and one answer might be that that's actually a meta fact, which is that in addition to the existence of these performances, we also somehow want to believe that they're not happening. And so we have to, we want to think that this is actually natural, spontaneous behavior, and that this speech wasn't rehearsed, and that there was no back room, and that there was no backstage, and this is backstage. And that's on top of the other requirements. Well, so, and there could be cases where we don't have that requirement.
So there's this classic speech technique, right? You must have seen it before, where somebody gets up there to give a speech and they pause and their eyes drip with tears, and they take the speech and they set it aside and they say, I had a speech I was going to give, but now I'm just going to speak from the heart.
Right.
Which is a speech they probably planned.
Right. But so like I have, gone a high ropes course. I have gone to a high ropes course with my kids. And at the beginning of the high ropes course, they give you this set of instructions and about how to do the clipping and all that. And every time, I mean, I've done it a number of times, they have to give you the instructions every time, even if you've heard it before. And it's the same every time. And I know it by heart now because we've done it a bunch of times. And that's fine. I don't expect it to be a fresh speech or something. I'm fine with the idea that there's just a canned safety speech they have to give. Right. So in that context, I'm not expecting innovation. I'm not expecting personalization. I'm fine with the idea of a canned safety speech that just shows up the same every time. Yet in other contexts, we're not. So the question is, when do we need this personalization?
So I just realized this intersects with a big interest area of mine, which is all the various professionals in our lives and how we pay them or how we incentivize them to be reliable and useful service people for us, right? And so I've been interested in all the different ways we could give them incentive contracts, like a contingent fee for a lawyer, or to merge health and life insurance. And I've noticed that a lot of people are just generally not that interested in various ways that their professionals could become more incentivized. And it's in part because they like the image being presented, that these professionals just like us and they are just professionals and have some professional sense of themselves. And that's the thing that will make them be trustworthy. And so they go with that, right? They try to present this concept of themselves as someone who's very dedicated to their professional ethics and their professional norms, and that they just kind of like us, and that they will do well by us because they like us and because they're professionals. And that's a front stage, right? And they have to coordinate to manage that stage. So the example of the doctor getting a kickback from the specialist, that undermines that professional liking you front stage. And some sense, many of our commercial relationships, I think, are somewhat misleading and that this is in some sense a valid Marxist criticism, if you like, that many kinds of commercial relationships in the modern economy, people are presenting themselves as more trustworthy than they really are. And we kind of like that. We like that pretense, and we like to sort of feel like we're in that world.
I mean, I think Goffman would say it's not pretense, and there's no deception involved here. So a phrase he uses a lot in the beginning of the book, though, he uses it less as he goes on, is the definition of the situation, right? So he thinks that's what you're doing. That's what the appearance management is. You're projecting a definition of the situation. And I think he thinks in some sense you're like, you're creating the definition, that, that it's not you're redefining or something. It's like, that this is what you're providing for people. And so imagine that just people are kind of lost. They're just like wandering around in the world and they don't know what to do. Right. And what we do is we're like, look, it's okay. I'm going to give you a definition of the situation that we're in. I'm going to act something and then you'll see where we stand. And, you know, if you think like that's a very basic function that people have for one another, that's just part of what it is to get along at all. Then like the thought, well, but not everything is included in the definition of the situation. You haven't given every single fact. It's like, of course not, right? It wouldn't be defined. It wouldn't be limited if it were everything, right? So if I'm a doctor, it's like, imagine I'm a doctor, right? And I walk up to you and I'm like, let me tell you everything. Let me tell you everything everything about myself. You're like, no, look, I need you to just present. I need to know what this interaction is. And I'm like, okay, let me play doctor. And that's what you want from me.
So it's clear that we will want a limited stereotyped relationship with each kind of person we're with, but there's also the question of which kind of relationship it is. So for many kinds of people we buy things from who are low class, we feel entitled and even obligated to be skeptical about their claims to us about what they might be selling us. Mm-hmm. So at a flea market or something, somebody says that this will help us. And we say, how do I know that'll help us? And we want them to sort of prove something about it. And we feel entitled to sort of haggle about the price or something. And then there are these high status relationships, like with your lawyer or your doctor. And because of their status, that framing makes us less willing to challenge them to renegotiate the price or to ask for evidence of effectiveness. And that's the part I would say is somewhat deceptive, in the sense that I don't think it's actually true that they're being high prestige people means that you can trust them more, or that you shouldn't feel as entitled to renegotiate the price.
That might literally just be what it means for them to be high prestige. Oh, those two things. That's all there is. Then you can trust them more. And yes, you shouldn't feel free to negotiate the price. That's all there is.
Trusting isn't an analytic, a thing by definition thing, right? I mean, trust is, the question is, are they trustworthy? If we trust them, will they
Goffman, that has a definite, like that has a meaning, right? And it's like, are they going to be good at maintaining this front? That is, can they sustain it? Will it break? Will the performance fail?
But that's if what you're, it is in the future. Well, so then the question is, when you're hiring a lawyer, did you actually want to win the case, or did you just want to go through the I hired a lawyer performance? Or when you hire a doctor, did you actually want to get well, or did you just want to have the I had a doctor meeting, visit performance, right? And that's for a lot of these things. When you went to the restaurant, did you just want to have a restaurant performance, or did you want the food to taste good?
Right. And I guess Goffman would say, look, I just wrote a whole book showing you a lot of evidence that what people want is the performance in a lot of these cases. And that may be because, so you want to ask, okay, when do we want performances and when do we just want like to buy a cheap thing, right? And you might say, well, there are certain parts of life where that feeling of being at sea is like very, very destabilizing or very significant or something. And so then we need there to be more stability provided by the acting, right? And so that's going to be like when our lives are at stake, right?
Go for the restaurant though. I mean, your life isn't at stake at the restaurant. And in principle, if it was just the performance, they wouldn't actually have to bring out any food you actually ate. They could just bring out the same plate with colorful, interesting smelling things, and you didn't touch it. You would just admire it, and then you would leave, right? So clearly, the reason why there's all the backstage parts is that you do want more than just the performance. Otherwise, there wouldn't be a backstage efforts, right? They wouldn't be cooking back there, right? Unless you, in addition to wanting the performance, you actually wanted the food.
Yes, in none of these cases do you just want the performance. That is, no one is satisfied with mere performance. But I think it's very clear that when people go to restaurants, like, why do so few people go to restaurants by themselves, right? It's because we're not there for the food. We're there for a certain kind of performance.
And now
the food is a necessary condition.
And this is what connects us now to the elephant in the brain. So now the thesis here is more closer to the thesis of the elephant in the brain about our hidden motives, right? Because now we're asking, what are the motives of the audience with respect to this performance?
And like, I guess one question is like, why think of it as hidden? That is, if you ask the person, why do you go to restaurants? They might well say, like the food or something, right? They might not well, they might well not have a full account of this performance thing. But you still might say like, well, you know, when you're presenting it to yourself in this context or being asked about it, then you're presenting it in this way. Like why think of it as, no, you somehow deceived yourself about what's going on.
Well, so for the restaurant, you might think you are somewhat honest about it, but when we get to examples like going to school or going to the doctor or giving to charity, then we get bigger conflicts between the story people will tell about why they're doing it and perhaps what seems to be a better explanation from their performative audience behavior. So if you tell people, you know what, on average, people go to the doctor more, they're not any healthier, then that shocks people. They find that very hard to believe. If you ask them, you know, aren't you going to the doctor because they've got the gray walls and the pastel and that makes you feel authoritative? And they, you know, they deny that they care very much about that.
Right. I mean, I guess I think, you know, they do think that the doctor is going to help them be healthier. And, but they want the person who's making them healthier, it's very important to them to be able to trust that person. Whereas the person they're buying stuff from at the flea market, it's not important to them that they're able to trust that person. And that difference, the do you care about trusting the person or not, that's them understanding that this is a performance context.
So let's watch the phrase. You said able to trust. Now, previously, you were just defining trust as sort of the having the performative relationship.
Yeah.
In which case, there's no question about able to trust.
Yeah.
So it suggests that they are, in fact, trusting on the basis of the performance. And so that's saying there's something behind the scenes they're trying to infer from the visible performance they see. And that may be, in fact, a mistaken inference. That is, they may not be actually getting the trustworthy behavior that they are seeking from the, you know, surface behavior that they are using as the sign of what to trust.
Right. But like, so there's a question, what would they count as the breakdown? And like, at least Goffman has the sense of like, it's pretty specific. What is the breakdown? And it's the breakdown of the performance, right? So like if the doctor let it be known that he was giving the kickbacks to the surgeon or whatever, right? That would be a breakdown of the performance.
Or the lawyer just doing as many hours of work as they can to bill per hour, even if those extra hours are not useful for the winning the case, that would also be a breakdown. And it might in fact be true that the lawyer is billing as many hours as they can, regardless of how useful the art of the case. But you take the oak mahogany setting and the leather chairs and the wall of books all in the same color backing and their fancy suit and haircut as a sign that you can trust them not to do that.
I suspect it's not just that you can take it as a sign to trust them, right? It also cues them into what kind of performance they have to do, right? And they have to do a performance where you will never discover certain things about them. And it's super important that you never discover those things. And in general, the best way to ensure that is not to do those things. Now, maybe occasionally they can cut some corners with some of these things, but there are standards here. There's professionalism, right? That's the performance. And that's going to mean they actually do the work for you. They look at those leather things and they're like, I better work. I'm in this like leather lined, whatever. I've got all these cues.
I don't see why we should assume that last part of it. That is that they would do the work effectively or efficiently. They may just, you know, they may help with your case, but they may also do a lot of extra stuff that they can bill for. So if we like, think of the con man or con woman sort of scenario, right? A con person is putting on a performance and then they are, you know, getting you to go along with their performance. And they are getting you to trust them. And then, you know, supposedly you shouldn't have been trusting them. And of course, the best con is one where the marks never find out. They never realize they were conned, right? Somebody sells you a fake painting, for example, you know, that was not the actual artist it says at the, you know, signature. Now, if you never know it was a fake painting, that's the best con of all. Now, would we say, well, that's a valid performance as long as you never figure it out?
Yeah, I was looking because I know that there's a place where he discusses comment, but I just can't find it. I mean, I think that I, I guess I think that there's like a, there's almost like a meta performance where it's like, all of these performances are not just performing, or right? Like we couldn't have it all fall apart. Like, so if everybody is doing their role and everyone's playing their part and like, and there are no embarrassing gaps and whatever, then everything's going to get done in society. So it's almost like, it's like we're playing a game of society, right? And we have to make everybody know that we're playing the game of society. And like in society, there are doctors and there are lawyers. And you might say, but like, what if I'm like a kind of radical skeptic? And I'm wondering, maybe everyone's going to be really good at playing their roles, but they're not actually going to be doing any of the things. And that's sort of your role, Robin, is to be the skeptic and to be like, what if we're all just playing society? And Goffman is not skeptical in that way. He's like, we're playing society and it works. It's a game, works pretty well. We're all really doing most of this stuff, but like a lot of it has to go to like showing each other that we're doing it.
So at some level, he is accepting the collective performance of all of us pretending like we're all getting stuff done.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So we could connect this to sort of the recent Russian army performance because it apparently seems like the Russian army was playing army, and you know, militaries when they're not at war can do all the usual performance of, you know, polishing their tanks and doing some marches and making sure you see rows of rifles or whatever. But when a war actually happens, you might find they're not actually any good at it. They can't actually fight the war, and you don't know that until you actually turn it on. So there are many kinds of things we trust that we don't get feedback frequently, and only every once in a while will we actually see the test. And you could say that's roughly true of doctors, in the sense that most of the time your whatever medical problems you have are pretty minor. Every once in a while there could be a big tough thing, and that'll be very rare, and it'll be too late if after that you learn that they weren't any trustworthy. And so in some sense, you know, the biggest problem of trusting society is when we're, you know, when a rare thing happens. So we could talk about COVID. You could say all the public health experts acted like they were all in control and understood things. And then we got a pandemic. And when they fumbled, didn't quite know what to do and changed their mind a lot and took a long time to get on track, well, that was sort of revealing that their performance was not what it was supposed to be.
Yeah. I mean, I was, you know, one thing that puzzled me about that whole thing with everyone like criticizing the public health experts is like, I didn't have an antecedent standard for how should they react in a pandemic. Like, I doubt that was the worst case scenario, right? But it's probably not the best case scenario. And it's probably pretty hard to figure out what to do in a pandemic, even if you're a public health expert. And like, my mom's a doctor, right? And she occasionally comes across cases where it's really hard to figure out what to do.
But basic things like all the experts initially saying, no, nobody needs masks. Masks are just for experts. And then changing their minds and no, everybody needs masks. And you think like, surely masks would have been a thing you guys have thought about before. You know, this isn't the first possible application of masks. You know, people use masks in the 1918 pandemic. I mean, you know, so.
But like, think about how we are, where we are now. Okay. 2 years later with masks. What do we know about how much masks prevent COVID or not, right?
Well, that means we don't know, which means at the beginning they didn't know either, which means they should have admitted they don't know. And part of the performance is to pretend they know more than they do. And so that's common for all of these things.
It's not at all obvious that what they should have done is admitted they don't know. I mean, imagine, right? Imagine we're at the beginning of the pandemic and all the public health experts, like, we have no clue. We're as lost as you are, right? I mean, you know, would we all have been better off?
That's a standard rationale for, right? So that's the standard rationale for authorities, like keeping regular people in the dark, is that, you know, the people would panic, right? And well, you certainly saw that rationale offered in the pandemic, is that we have to pretend like we know what we're doing and give authoritative, confident advice. And that's a standard thing doctors do, by the way. Doctors are way overconfident in their diagnosis and their prognosis. And that's a well-known statistic, but they say, well, that's just what those stressed out patients need, is they need somebody who's confident to tell them what to do.
And like, at least let's say this, right? You know, one thing one can dispute is like how much doctors should overrepresent their knowledge. And maybe you think the answer is zero, but like that, it seems like an empirical question. Like maybe that would just be too problematic. Maybe they should overrepresent it by a little bit and then they might overshoot, right? But I think Goffman's thought is like, well, look, if your thought is there should just be no performance, then you're just underrating the degree where to which people are lost in the game of life, and they need some guidance. And they
so now we're getting to the core thing, right? So the key question here is, why have we divided the world into these front stage and backstages?
Yeah.
Why don't we want to see the backstage? One story is it's our sort of sensibilities, like, you know, maybe they kill the chicken backstage. We don't want to see them kill the chicken. And so, you know, that's why the kitchen is backstage or something, or, you know, that we don't want to see how the sausage is made. It's ugly. And that they're just saving us from ugly things. But another theory is that they are hiding the fact that they aren't as trustworthy as they let on, and we are giving them too much of the benefit of the doubt.
I think it's something else. I don't think it's either one of those things. I think it's that. If you ever tried to cook with your kids, you discover
they're very helpful, huh?
Yeah, everything takes 10 times as long and it makes a huge mess. And suddenly you're like, you realize you have to like explain everything that you're doing, and all those things were like intuitive to you, but you didn't necessarily have like a fear. You didn't even notice you were doing it. You're like, no, don't take the spoon and just put it on the counter. You know, all of a sudden you have to say all this stuff, right? So there's expressing cooking. There's communicating cooking, right? That's one thing. And there's cooking. That's another thing. And they're just really different, and they put different demands on you. And it's not because when I'm cooking, there's a bunch of stuff I want to hide from other people. It's just how I cook efficiently is that I'm not at every moment also trying to communicate cookery to other people around me. Right. And so that's just an interesting fact about human activity, that the communicative direction and the efficiency direction don't pull in the same thing. And it's not because of anything about deception.
There are many restaurants who show you the kitchen, right? They put a glass, right. They don't let you talk to the, or they don't let you talk or interrupt the cooks, right? There's usually a glass wall there. And so
nowadays, this is a new thing,
right?
But yes.
A new thing, right? And so it's interesting that they cut off that communication problem, but they let you see the cooking happening. And that many people like that sort of backstage connection. And one of the things in the book that just struck me, because it echoes last week's topic, was talking about how on ships, old day ships, there was this norm that in the galley, you could say anything you want, and there were no status distinctions. And that was an important way that sort of rumors, you know, and tensions would be relieved, so that you might think the galley is a kitchen and you want to need to keep the front stage, backstage distinction. And of course, there's the officers and the lower deck people, and they will need to keep that distinction. And the idea was that, well, we need a place where the distinction isn't kept, where then they can treat each other as equals in that one place. And they, you know, and one of the marks of that backroom equal treating place is free speech. It was a norm that if you said something, if you insulted an officer in the galley, he shouldn't take it out on you up on deck later on. Whatever was said there was to be kept separate from all the other decks. And that is kind of an interesting metaphor for the norm of free speech. It's sort of a very vivid, concrete example of sort of the norm that you shouldn't have consequences elsewhere for what's said in a certain kind of forum.
Right. So that, I mean, if we take that as our model, then the idea of public free speech is a contradiction in terms, right? It's like, look, if you want to talk about this stuff, go find your little separate,
the question
find
is,
a safe space.
The question is what the function of it being public or private is for the galleys. So, you know, apparently, you know, these galleys, lots of people could show up there and people would gossip about it. So, I mean, part of the story was that in that section was that on a ship like that, there's really nothing you ever could say that could be really kept that private, because almost everything will be overheard. And because of that, you didn't have these private spaces where you could say things. And so that's one of the functions of the galley, was to be a space where you could say private-like things. And the norm was, you know, you treated that differently.
Right. But the point is that it substitutes for a private space. Right. And so like people who want free speech, free from consequences, they want public spaces to be like that, which would be front stage. They want front stage to be. And so that's like wanting front stage to be backstage. So that wouldn't.
I think it's not entirely crazy in the sense that, you know, in most of these cases, you might say, you know, the problem is like insulting people and things you might say about other people personally. And what people want about the public stage is for them to talk about public issues and not be talking about each other personally there. And they, you know, they want a norm where you can just be abstract and and that's okay. We're not going to treat each other personally there on the basics of what we say abstractly there. But I'm not sure how much it really helps us understand front stage versus backstage, but it was an interesting sort of function there that sometimes we need that. So another thing I guess Goffman said was that a servant, for example, or a person with a servant would be somewhat distant and you know, pretend like they aren't there and treat them emotionally distantly, except when they really wanted a favor. And then to get a favor, they would then become more personal. And so they would overcome sort of the, you know, they would step out of the distant relationship role in order to make an appeal for something that is beyond the usual request. And that's kind of interesting how it's like the old thing about, worlds where, say, you never see a woman's ankle. And then when you see a woman's naked ankle, it's very erotic or something. In a world where you're not very personal with people, then the rare exceptions can feel very personal. And there's something to that of, if everybody's very chummy and casual with each other, then there's nothing so special about being back in the kitchen with the other staff and being very chummy and casual with each other. And that, so, there's the issue of what's happening over the last half century or so as we become more casual and we've reduced these distinctions between front and backstages. And, it might be that this is because we've become more egalitarian or more intolerant of what we see as hypocrisy. But, an interesting cost is that it's less special when we are personal and, take off our shoes. Because we're always taking off our shoes and we're always personal.
Yeah, good. So maybe it's worth being specific, because you and I have talked about this, but not on this podcast, that one of the big takeaways for both of us with Goffman is that he gives us a way of talking about a change, a big sociological change that seems to have happened since, when was this book written? 1950 or something?
54, I think.
Okay. I mean, it was already underway, but... that people describe as like we're less formal or more casual. But I think it's the full breadth of the phenomenon is actually best captured by thinking about front stage, backstage goes on stage or something, that this distinction is collapsing and that stuff that used to be backstage is now front stage. And that's everything from, there's questions about whether doctors should wear white coats. People wear very, more similar clothes at home and at work. People are working from home. People don't use formal titles as much. Even the language on the news, like the articulations and whatever, are less different, right? I once dated a German guy who, there was this big thing of like at home they spoke dialect, but his dad at like school would speak High German, right? So like two different languages almost that, are the front stage and the backstage. So there were all these, very rich, different front stage, backstage situations that are somewhat breaking down. And we are, I think we're also more inclined to see the front stage, backstage distinction in the way that you do as hypocrisy, deception, lying. And like many of Goffman's examples, he seems sort of charmed by it. He seems delighted by the performance, entertained by it. That's his basic response. He quotes a lot of literary examples. So one that we discussed was like this example where these girls in a dorm would let the phone ring a bunch of times so that the other girls would know that they were sought after. And I think in a modern version of this, it would be like, superficial and performative or whatever act. But I think Goffman, I don't think he passes judgment on it. And so part of it is like these things are breaking down partly because we're inclined to see the idea of there being stuff backstage that you don't want to bring front stage as false or fake or deceptive, as opposed to just there just being two different roles.
One of the things we had discussed previously was maybe the hypothesis that quite often front stage and backstage is layered with a relative status, and that we are asserting these relative statuses by managing this distinction. And without that distinction, it's harder to assert status, and we are therefore left with fewer status markers, and maybe that's what we want. And maybe then we resent each front stage, backstage as another sort of excuse to have status markers. And if we are asked to endorse it, we are seen as endorsing extra status markers that maybe we don't need.
Right.
So if a caddy at the golf course has to wear special caddy clothes, maybe I would feel embarrassed. I say, fine, I need a caddy. Let him be there, but let him wear whatever clothes he wants.
Yeah.
Because I feel bad that somehow, you know, I'm asserting my higher status at his lower status expense because I make him wear caddy clothes.
Right. Like taxis are another good example, right? Like I think the
taxi caps. I've never seen an Uber driver wearing a taxi cap.
Exactly. Like Uber and Lyft are the front stage goes backstage version of like we were driving, from the airport to the airport a couple days ago. And it was when my 9-year-old learned for the first time, this was someone's car. Like this was just the guy's car who's driving it. And he wouldn't believe me. And I had to say it like 4 different ways. I'm like,
right.
I'm like, he's like, well, he's driving the car. I'm like, no, this is just his car that he owns that we're, cause I was telling him like, don't put your feet on the seat. Right. Like, this is someone's car. And he's like, well, it's someone's. I'm like, no, this is just this guy. He just owns this car. And he's just driving. Right. And he couldn't believe we were just going to get in a car that was just someone's car. Right. And, I think I would have been very shocked as a, I don't know, teenager or something to think like, cause like a taxi is like, okay, I'll get in it. Cause it's an official car to drive you places, but just getting in someone's personal car, it seems like hitchhiking. Like I would have thought I will never catch on because that'll be like hitchhiking. So I think Uber and Lyft, like they couldn't have caught on 50 years ago, even if we, you know, somehow had the technology, we didn't have smartphones,
well, but they'd make them wear a cap and a special clothes in the car or something.
Right.
Wouldn't be that expensive, but yeah, they would have made them or maybe put a special, like often they had these little things you put on the top of a cab, a special little, you know, light on top. And maybe they would have made them put that there just to, now it becomes officially a cab, but put a little light on top.
Right. So maybe there would have been a workaround, but, in any case, like, I feel like now is the time for that.
So I tweeted this, I think a while ago, but like 6 months ago or something, I went to some big fancy hotel and, you know, there were not only were the staff wearing sort of hotel uniforms, but the staff were all wearing masks and everybody else was not. And that was part of the, you know, the distinction of roles and the stage, right? And I felt bad for them, all these people working hard, having to wear masks and the rest of us not wearing masks. And I guess I would have a similar reaction if they thought the clothing they had to wear to do the work was uncomfortable. Because I might think, well, I don't want you to be uncomfortable. Sure, I need these things done, but you know, wear whatever is comfortable. And so.
Right. So you're a creature of your time. Namely, you object to this performance, right?
Sometimes people ask me, why don't I have a tweed jacket as a professor, right?
People have asked you that. No one's ever asked.
Once upon a time, that was a tradition. Right? Professors had their own sort of clothing as to distinguish their roles, and now, you know, basically they don't. Almost no one really wears professor clothes.
Right.
And I think I would feel a little off. So the main time people wear clothes is a job tuck, right? They wear job tuck clothes.
Yeah, exactly.
But otherwise, they're just wearing ordinary clothes. And I would think somebody who sort of walked around wearing professor clothes and labeling that way, I would feel it would feel a little awkward.
Right. So in fact, there's now like controversy over should you wear a suit for a job talk? And I think you can just get, there'll be someone who responds to you negatively if you do, and there'll be somebody who responds to you negatively if you don't. Because if you do, that's like, oh, you know, you're doing this performance, you know, and if you don't, it's like, well, it's a job talk.
Right.
So I think we're at the middle stage where you can't win. But eventually, probably that will go away and people won't wear suits for job talks. But it's interesting if you think about it, it's like, if we had been living, you know, 70 years ago, we would have been like, of course we got to wear the professor clothes. And so this is a new thing. It's a new psychological phenomenon. This feeling that you have where it's like the wait staff at the hotel shouldn't have to wear uniforms. Like that would have been so bizarre, I think, to people. It's like, what do you mean they shouldn't have there? That's what they are, is wait staff. Of course they have to wear the uniforms. But it's like the idea that there is a communicative role that they have to play, right, that is part of their job. And for weights, you know, the percent of your job that is, right, it's a function of what kind of job. So if you're wait staff, right, that's a big percent of your job. If you're the cook, that's like a small percent of your job. Right. If you're a professor, it's like a pretty big percent of your job.
So there are many events if I'm at, and I look around, and I say, who works here? Like, who's an official person I could ask in an official capacity? And then I want them to be wearing something distinctive so right. I can find them easily and distinguish them, right?
Right.
Or like there's a reception and somebody's walking around, you know, giving out drinks, and they should wear something distinctive so I can look around and find where to get a drink. Right. Or an hors d'oeuvre or something, right? So there are right. cases where it's actually functionally useful for them to look different.
Right, right. Or in a store, if it's like Home Depot and you want to know who works there so you can ask
exactly,
them a question.
Exactly, right.
Right. But I guess I think that it was functionally useful. Like, you know, like the doctor wearing a white coat. Now, first of all, nowadays, like more people wear white coats, like even nurses right. and stuff wear white coats, right? So the white coat is not useful for distinguishing the doctor from a nurse if you wanted to draw that distinction.
But it does might distinguish a medical professional, say. So a pharmacist might wear a white coat and a veterinarian would wear a white coat and things like that. You know, so they're trying right. to say, I am a medical professional. I'm keeping clean in a way you can verify that I'm clean and that sort of thing.
Right. But like how often is that useful information that you actually need, like, so, as opposed to a certain kind of reassurance?
I realized that a while ago, I came across this issue in thinking about Halloween costumes. Mm. So, kids like Halloween costumes, and on Halloween, sort of, they inhabit this imaginary world where different kinds of people wear different kinds of clothes. And it's not just that it simplifies the world; it's in some sense more interesting world. So, if you think about a classic fantasy world, we often have fantasy worlds where these different kinds of people, like they may be different races or different, you know, classes, but they're often different professions. And they're often like have different professions that live together and teach, learn things together. And they wear distinctive clothes and they have different slogans and they have sing different songs and they have a loyalty oath that they pledge to each other. And a lot of people sort of find that very appealing. That's part of the appeal, I think, of Halloween, is this idea that you put on this costume and then you become this person. That is, you can inhabit this persona more vividly by putting on a costume, and you can imagine. You know, you put on the pirate costume and you're a pirate, right? And now you can talk like a pirate and imagine being swarthy like a pirate and greedily eating your soup like a pirate might. And you like to have this whole package of lifestyle features that would go together by wearing a particular thing, and that people would accept that from you. If they saw you wearing the pirate costume, and they saw you behaving that way, they would accept that from you. And we've given that up in some sense. That is, people wear distinctive things, but they don't have all these other distinctive styles that go with the distinctive thing that they're doing.
Right, like Sartre's waiter that Goffman quotes, where there's a whole performance. There's a right. whole mode of like servility that he's playing. Right. And you might say, oh, I feel bad that he has to do that, but maybe he liked that. Like, he liked
became
playing.
Somebody.
Yeah, he became exactly. So I think that's the thing. When I was saying the definition of the situation, there's that become yeah. somebody where it's like we're inclined to take for granted that everybody is somebody, right? But imagine right. you didn't start with that. Imagine you're like, nobody has any idea who anybody is. And then Goffin's like, it's okay, because we're going to have these roles that we play. And that's a way for people to be somebody, right? And there's that wonderful quote from a novel where the guy is at the beach, right? And do you remember that one at the very beginning where there's like this what's his name? He's at the beach and he is performing, the water of the beach, and he's performing in front of like the imagined other beach goers,
Purdy or something.
Yeah. Preeti.
That's right.
Like for instance, he's pretending not to see the other beach goers, right? As though the beach was empty. His eyes are sort of on the horizon. Right. He has this fake nonchalance and this carelessness, right? And it's like, what, that's the whole thing he's doing is he's someone at the beach, right? He's playing the role of someone. So, he weren't doing that, he'd be no one.
So it occurs to me that there's a datum that seems relevant here, which is if you say music from 3 or 4 centuries ago, the most popular music was music that most everyone could sing and would sound pretty good from most anyone's voice. And then over time, we came to like music that of a very particular performance of a very distinctive artist, and only they can do it well. And the rest of us, when we sing karaoke, try to sing it, it sounds pretty crappy. And lots of other arts have moved like that way too. So three, four centuries ago, the best sculptor was someone who would sculpt in exactly the same way that the best classic sculptors would class. The best ones could be distinguished by looking like each other, and the best painters. And today art is, the best is very distinctive and such that nobody else could do it like you do. And I think that's even true of intellectuals. Like once upon a time, the best scholars were the ones who knew the same thing all the other best scholars knew. Mm. And now the best intellectuals have their own distinctive intellectual thesis or style. And that seems relevant here to this trend in the sense that in the old days, there were all these different types and you would aspire to become one of those types and become the best of those types. And that was the thing everybody aspired to, right? And now we aspire to be these unique things such that like dressing like other doctors just makes you another doctor. You're supposed to be this unique doctor, or dressing like other professors just makes you another professor. You're supposed to be this unique professor. And I think that's part of what's going on here is sort of, if I look to dress too much like a professor, I'm sort of acknowledging I'm not going to be a unique professor. I'm not a distinctive professor. I'm just another professor.
Yeah, good. And so then I guess it's like there's a trade-off between how you're going to be somebody that is not be nobody, right?
Right.
One way you could be somebody is to be a person of a particular type. Right. And then it's like, okay, I'm just a professor like the other professors. We all dress the same. We all talk the same. But now we're like, no, I don't want to be somebody that way. That's fake. Right. That's inauthentic. That's not being the real me. I want to be something completely idiosyncratic and have some weird office behind me and wear weird clothes. Right. And
I know nothing about this. Right.
And that's how I'm going to be somebody. Right. And when somebody in our culture, right, is looking at somebody in Goffman's culture, and we're looking at them, say, making the phone ring 3 times, or we're like, that's so fake, right? But they looking at us might be like, these people are absurd. Like, she's just a professor. Why does she have to act like she's different from all the other professors? Why does she take up all this energy and time? I mean, how much time would it have taken her to decorate this office, right?
Right.
And like to have special headphones made that are different colors. And she's putting all this effort in. It's so inefficient, right? When she could just wear professor clothes, get that over and done with, and then get to her professoring, right? And so you might think the additional effort or the inefficiency is still there. Right. It's just somewhere else.
And so, this is related to the observation that over the last century, we've had enormous increase in wealth, but we've spent most of it on variety rather than just quantity. So, a century ago, people, to the extent they were rich, they had the biggest house they could have, or the biggest car, and the biggest, fanciest coat, or things like that. But they were all pretty similar to each other. They had this pretty much the same coats and the same cars and the same houses. They just had the same meals, and they just had the biggest ones they could. And we've gotten a lot richer, but instead of having much bigger houses and much bigger meals and much bigger even wardrobes, et cetera, we've decided to have variety where we each need our very distinctive colorful headphone. And instead of sort of the best, most expensive one or that was the same as lots of other people's. And that's sort of an overall social trend in the last century, is we've spent most of our increased wealth on variety. And here we could say Goffman is letting us notice that people have spent most of their increased effort at career success at variety as well. That is, they are less eager to be the generic cab driver. And maybe they want to be the distinctive cab driver that pitches you their movie script as you ride with them. and, you know, maybe you have a story to tell about the distinctive driver you rode with. And that's the kind of thing people aspire to, is to be these unique, distinctive personas as career people, as well as making their offices distinctive and everything else.
Do you think, I mean, I wonder, like, is that, how does that relate to egalitarianism? One way to think about it is it's backlash against egalitarianism. It's like, okay, fine, we're all equal, but I'm special because I have a colorful office.
Right.
Like that fundamentally, none of us is okay with egalitarianism, because that means I'm just like everybody else, but right. I want to be different, special. And so that'd be one theory about it, but right. I don't know what other possibilities.
Well, we could just decide that being a professional like other people was just not good enough. That is, we're just going to shoot higher because we can't. So, you know, basically, you know, the basic long-term trend is we were all really poor and then we could afford more stuff and we could afford more interesting careers and we could afford more interesting jobs. And the first thing was just to move from very basic, you know, materials up to something better. And then at some point we decided that like bigger wouldn't be better. It would show off more features of ourselves to be unique in a special way. So people like complain about McMansions. I don't, you know, right. People complain that some people are rich. They just buy a bigger house and they might say, well, how boring house, you know, that doesn't show very much interesting. Like other people, they spend all that extra wealth on buying a special sort of, you know, downtown apartment or condo where they decorated with art that they've chosen personally. And, you know, they arrange particular unique ways they structure it. And they're showing off all these individual personal features other than their wealth by how they make it unique. So you might think just being bigger does shows a certain capacity, but if you're trying to show that you're excelling, then you try to be more unique as to show that you are the very best.
But it also seems like the way you just put it is like you're more competitive, right? But it's a different kind of competition. Like it's
more deniable that you're trying to be higher than
exactly.
people. I get that. Yes.
Exactly.
So
right.
You can pretend you're just trying to express your individuality.
Exactly. So it may be that sort of expressing your individuality is like the sweet spot where people still feel you know, like they're not just like everybody else, which nobody wants to be.
Right.
But they're not at the same time saying I'm better than other people. So it's like one thing that we are looking for, that we're deeply searching as a society, is ways of saying I'm not just like everybody else that don't entail I think I'm better than other people. That's like one of our deep problems that we're constantly in.
Right. But now take musicians, right? So like I said, musicians today are trying to be unique performers, right? They aren't replaceable with others. They have their own style, their own instruments, their own cadence of their music, their own kind of theme in their music. They make this whole unique package that's distinctively theirs. And you might think, like we have, say, the Grammy Awards, where we pick the best of them. And you might think they would be offended by the Grammy Awards if they say, no, I'm not trying to be better. I'm just trying to be different here. And there'd be this big movement to sort of boycott any awards thing that would make any of them sort of be explicitly celebrated. They might just say, I'm glad a lot of people like my music, but I'm not doing it for other people. I'm doing it just for me.
Yeah.
And there's some of that, but not so much as you'd think.
But probably more of it than there used to be, is my guess.
Yeah, sure. Right.
And like, there's a lot of, I mean, if you think about the way people behave at award ceremonies, I mean, one question would be, if you could look at that behavior over time, has it changed, right? But there's this like massive performance of humility that is required of a person, right? If they get an award, what they have to do is like talk about how other people actually are the reason why they got the award immediately. They're like, here are all the people I have to thank who really did this.
It would be actually funny to see a movie of Caesar like coming down the parade after of his triumph and giving the speech of how he didn't really deserve this and it wasn't him, it was the troops.
Exactly.
His family is to be credited and he was just lucky in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, right. It's always your family. Right, exactly. So I mean, I think that there is, if you want to know like what is a part of life where there's like a massive amount of performance, the answer is award ceremonies, right? Right. Because it's like that is a tightrope that they have to walk in terms of, you know, you have to be honored, you have to be flattered, you have to be you have to perform as that beautiful actor, actress. Right. You can't like, you really can't reveal that you want to win.
And it's actually pretty striking. So you might think somebody like Jack Nicholson or something, they have this contrarian persona where they're just going to do the opposite and be honest. And you might think one of them would just try to walk up to this, to the microphone and say, yeah, I deserve this. I am better.
Right.
And that would sort of fit with their brand, and people would sort of, yeah, that's a Jack Nicholson, but nobody ever does that.
Right.
That would be a bridge too far.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Right. Right. Because it's like, it's very important. Like, here's the thing I think would not at all work. If somehow instead of an Academy Awards committee, which I don't know who those people are, who are like somehow behind the scenes choosing who they think is the best actors, if the actors had to give speeches explaining why I did the best performance this year,
right? Exactly.
Really, look at what I did over here. I was better than anybody.
Yeah,
that would be totally unacceptable, right? So they're not really competing. I mean, there are competitions. Competitions exist, right? But
you don't explain why you win. So, but that's like venture capital is interestingly different that way, right? And that, in some sense, is one of the ways people are uncomfortable with business. if you want to go get funding for your venture, you have to stand there and make a pitch about why your business is better.
Right.
And even we academics, like when we give a talk, we're kind of telling people why our topic is important. We're blowing our own horn a bit. And I understand that Europeans think that we Americans go too far in that direction. They underplay themselves and they need somebody else to praise them. And, you know, and they look down somewhat on Americans who are just too forthrightly braggish about our stuff. And, you know, when Europeans come here, we tell the students, no, you need to brag more about your stuff. You can't just sort of hint that it might be interesting. You need to say why it's great. But that's somewhat at odds with this larger social norm of, you know, I'm just a different scholar. I'm studying my own stuff. I'm not any better than anybody else. I just happen to be interested in this thing. And if you like it, that's great. But
yeah, that's interesting because I think that like in, the problem with that, I'm just doing my own thing is like, but in a lot of these cases, you have to attract people to your thing somehow.
Right.
You have to make them read your book or whatever. And so
buy
your music. Right. And so in effect, you have to get them to conclude that your thing is better than some other things, but you have to do that without yourself saying any of that. Right. And that's like self-promoting. It's bad to be self-promoting, right? Somehow other people have to promote you. Other people can say, oh, she's better than the other singers.
Right.
But I'm not supposed to say that.
So it's interesting to know how the old style that Goffman is describing allows you to avoid being so selfish. So if I'm a cab driver and I'm saying cab drivers are great, we're maligned, we're doing all this stuff for the city, we are good people, I can be saying that about me, but in my mind, emotionally saying that about all the other cab drivers that I know and love, and I'm less blowing my own horn and blowing our horn, right? And so in some sense, you have to be sort of more arrogant and selfish in our world than you would be in this old world. In the old world, I'm a professor and I'm telling you how great professors and scholars are. I'm not necessarily, I am one, and indirectly I'm saying I'm great by that way, but I'm mostly emotionally and literally pointing you to all the other scholars and saying, I wanted to join this group because look, I saw all these great things they were doing and this is a community I wanted to be part of. And that's a way in which, you know, people are less, we're less arrogant in some sense, right?
Right. So like, in a way, that's part of what the costume or the what's it called, like uniform, right, that you wear gets you, is that you're not performing as yourself. You're performing as, you know, a doctor or a waiter or something. And now we're always performing as ourselves. And so we're very self-centered and kind of arrogant and a bit narcissistic, right? Because every single time, and I think social media increases, right, you're always performing as yourself, right?
Right.
And so that's
Are there even any community accounts? I mean, that would be kind of interesting to see on Twitter or something, like a community account where like it's 10 people. So The Economist magazine does this thing where the articles are not authored by individual people. And that's pretty rare in the media, because most have bylines by individuals. But sometimes there are these communities. And so in some sense, when you're an economist journalist, you are part of that community. You're not an individual. You are promoting the Economist brand, but not your own brand. Although you might privately tell people which articles were yours.
Right. So that's like the New York Times editorial board also has, like, right, you know.
So we do sometimes retreat to this sort of communal persona. And we certainly might do that in firms or something. So, you know, Google presents itself to the public and it doesn't necessarily say who inside Google did any one thing that Google does.
Mm.
And in some sense, firms are sort of our main remaining communal production and facade.
So that could explain, at least partly, one of the reasons why people are so suspicious of and opposed to firms, right? Because we now have become much less tolerant of this facade. And the firm is only a facade. I mean, that's never going to break down, right? Because there's no person. It's literally not it's a person of that kind, right? And so the firms are in a way stuck in the past because they're stuck in this old model.
Right.
Metaphysically stuck. They're never going to be anything else, right? Of there's a facade and there's going to be like a PR team or whatever, right? And there's going to be a brand, literally a brand of like Nike or whatever. And I wonder whether now any entity that is in that position of being stuck, like, so you imagine, right? You get the societal shift where we all move towards, backstage moves front stage, right? What happens to people? Like, well, intellectuals like you and me just start being more idiosyncratic and wearing different clothes and, you know, being ourselves or whatever. And it's like, we adapt, right? Like we're now in a different ecosystem. And so we just allow backstage to go front stage. But now you look at these dinosaurs, you know, things like firms, businesses, right? That can't adapt in this way. They can't allow backstage to go front stage because
They won't go away. So they're not dinosaurs in the sense of sort of being the last of something.
Oh, right. Away, no, right. I didn't mean.
And governments and charities are also in some sense like this. Our major organizations are, you know, the U.S. government says something. We don't necessarily say who in the government figured that out or decided to say that.
Right. But something I was thinking about was if you think about, firms are now more vulnerable. That is, they're going to be more negatively received by people because they're putting up a front and we're less tolerant of fronts. And maybe that's partly why they are also now they seem to be sort of more cowardly in the sense of they're going to fire someone if that person is, does something that looks bad on social media. And universities too, right?
Like right.
Any large organization, in effect, the management of your image has become an almost impossible task. And so you're just gonna, the possibilities for bad behavior have sort of increased and become more.
So there could be an asymmetry in being unique about good things versus bad things. So, you know, if there's a famous engineer at Google, then Google can shine from knowing they have this famous engineer at Google. But if somebody gets a reputation for being a bad guy and is at Google, Google may not be as willing to tolerate that association. Because they're mostly sort of a unified shared identity rather than, you know, distinctive individuals.
Right. And it's like, if you imagine in the olden days, if you were a restaurant or something, and it was asked, how do you manage your public image or something? The answer would be, well, we have our waiters and they wear these uniforms. I went to the Russian Tea Room in Chicago a couple of days ago, and I noticed that the waiters didn't really wear a uniform. They sort of wore like black and white, but they could kind of wear their own clothes, right? And then, in fact, the door to the back room was like halfway open, and I saw someone like eating a banana. I don't mind she's eating a banana, but I did notice, this is a fancy restaurant, so I'm eating a banana.
Right.
But on the one hand, it's like this restaurant, which clearly was once very formal, is now much less formal, even though it would still be one of the more formal restaurants in Chicago. But here's some other things. There's a giant Ukrainian flag in the window. There's a special menu where if you order off of that menu, everything goes to Ukraine, right? And you might have imagined that in earlier time, maybe they wouldn't have to do all that.
Well, that would be out of character in some sense, right? I don't know about Russian, but like there are many Italian restaurants in the US where the brand is, we're an Italian restaurant. We're going to give you the Italian restaurant experience. And if they had some unique thing about that, that would kind of take away from, you know, the unique brand of we're the sort of fancy Italian restaurant.
Right. But my thought is like when there's less of a brand, then you're more subject to just the whims of public opinion. So that all of a sudden there's a war with Ukraine. And now the Russian Tea Room has to behave differently because it doesn't have this solid facade of the waiters and whatever, all that's gone away. And it's now kind of floating in the wind. And the same is true of Apple. And the same is true of universities. They're just unmoored because part of what stabilized them was all this presentation that we're no longer doing.
Although, I mean, you have to realize the contrary trend is, you know, 300 years ago, there were almost no large organizations. So almost all businesses were very small. And so you only really had brands on sort of professions and generic kinds of products. And, you know, Apple's a brand now because there's an organization that has the brand Apple, and that sort of thing just didn't exist 3 centuries ago. Mm. So we've had the rise of these big shared corporate brands as we've decreased these sort of brands of professions and particular styles of interactions.
Mm.
So now, like, we have Disney as a brand and there's a Disney experience, whereas there might have been once the Italian restaurant experience, but nobody owned that. And anybody anywhere could try to create the Italian restaurant experience, and everybody did. And now we have brands that are like owned by someone like Disney, and they create and they manage the brand. But now we are more suspicious of it because, well, it's got this for-profit motive behind it.
I'm suggesting there's a different reason for suspicion, which is just that there's a brand at all. And but so the interesting connection to me is that if you think about, like, it's a possible driver of cancel culture that I hadn't thought of before, which is that, like, the real pressure point, the real weak point is, like, whoever's going to fire someone, right? So are you going to fire your employee because whatever, a whole bunch of people are mad at them? And you might imagine that, like, in an earlier time, like, you just wouldn't care, right? You'd just be like, whatever those people think, we're still the restaurant, we're still the university, we're still the whatever, right? But
it's also like the professional identification, right? So if we less identify with ourselves as professionals of a certain type, then these other identities are going to shine brighter. So I would think in the past, if you had an engineer and he was your engineer and you were engineers together and outsiders were attacking them, but for something they did that wasn't an engineer, then you might say, well, you know, I care about them as an engineer and they're a great engineer. So, you know, let's ignore that other stuff. But now you might identify less with us as engineers and these other identities stand out more.
Right. And part of that is just they don't wear engineer clothes anymore.
Right.
Right. So that's what that was getting us. Right. It wasn't nothing to make them wear the engineer clothes. And so it's like, you know, if you think about all of this acting or performance or whatever that Goffman is like documenting and that we're doing less of it, if we're doing less of it, we're also...
So we should notice people are doing an enormous amount of performing as a member of their political tribe.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And, you know, in some sense, they even wear... So, you know, we have the separation but geographically of different political tribes, like moving in different places. And then these different places just have different styles, right? Different kind of restaurants and clothes and other things. And so in some sense, as we've decreased sort of this professional identity with the professional style, we've replaced this political identity and style. Though it's still pretty weak, but, you know, if you think of a hipster, for example, a hipster has a particular identity and style in terms of clothes and hair and things like that, but it's not a professional style.
I think it can be pretty unclear. We had discussion. We often discuss around the dinner table, which one of us is hipster and are we hipsters? Like, it's hard to know. We're like genuine and like,
But if one of you was a cab driver, you would notice that, hipsters. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So hipster is like a little bit, it's a little bit, you know. Right.
And so our identities are more invasive and like, there's more to them. They higher bar
and
to
we're,
meet.
And we deny them. Like, you know, we're inclined to deny them. Like, no one wants to say that they're a hipster. We call other people. So that having one of these personas is a bad thing. We see it as about because you're acting, you're fake. Oh, you're performing your political identity. That means you're a deceitful actor, right? And so it's not just that we've shifted these things over. It's that the very image of it as being a performance is one that we now see as fake and a problem. And so the only people who will talk about it that way are people who are not doing it, right? Because they're, you know, to identify it is to be alienated from it.
I think we've gone over our time because we didn't start on a time here. So we should probably end now, but it's been nice chatting today.
Yeah.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.